Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, September 7th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. Happy National Beer Lovers Day, of all things.
Uh-huh.
Yes, beer likely predates known history, but in written colonial times, we know that, well, Virginia colonists brewed beer, and William Penn, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, included a place for brewing beer in the Pennsylvania colony.
William Penn or the beer brewer?
Oh, William Penn.
One of the same.
You know, it can be still be visited at Pensbury Manor today, the brewery.
Wow.
Washington recorded a recipe for brewing beer in his notes, and, well, Samuel Adams, of course, holds a dear place in both beer and tea history in this country. The U.S. gets its rich brewing history mainly from our beer-loving German ancestors who immigrated here during the 1617 and 1800s, so today, enjoy your favorite beer or lager, and be sure to enjoy it with family and friends. So raise your mug and lift it high, ladies and gentlemen. And while you do, send a toast to those like my daughter who work at a beer brewery in or around your hometown. Here's to victory, Melody.
Victory. All right.
Beer, that is.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and celebrate gold being up $2.30.
There you go.
Hey, it's higher. It's not lower. $1,919. Silver, though, down 23 cents at $23.02. We can celebrate silver being down for the buyers. It's a great deal for them. Platinum was down 5 at $916, and palladium was also down 6, $1,246. The USDX today was stronger by 0.18 at 105.02. Crude oil basically unchanged, 87.07. Paper markets today, we have, drum roll please, the Dow up 57 points at 34,005. The S&P was down 14 and the NASDAQ was down 123. At 13,748, former FTX executive Salami to forfeit $1.5 billion, and he pleads guilty to two criminal counts. So there you have it. That's what happens, you know. I think they're all making their agreements and everything so they can all turn on the head guy of FTX. That's what they all do. But anyway, let's go ahead and get to the other markets. And let's see if I can bring it up here. European markets, the DAX was down barely 22 points. Asia was down across the board. The hefty ones were the, although the Nikkei wasn't down over 1%, the Hang Seng was down 250. That's 1.33%. So it really wasn't all that bad. 10-year yield was down a little bit lower. It pulled back 4.25. And my natural gas was higher by 3% at 2.59. And it'll be interesting. Apple shares fell. They lost over $200 billion in 2 days because China's banned iPhone use by government employees. So isn't that interesting? Well, make you wonder to see if he pulls his phone manufacturing out of China after that.
But yeah, really.
You know? So I wonder what he did. Shame on you. So, but anyway, let's go ahead and see what we got. Well, you know, the G20 meeting is going to be heated up, and that begins. Well, I don't know when does. What's the actual date that that begins?
The 9th and the 10th.
The 9th and the 10th. So it's in New Delhi. Again, it's the group of 20, and you know, we'll just have to see how that goes. You know, the United States commitment to the G20, you know, I really don't, the group of 20 represents 85% of global GDP, 75% of international trade, and 2/3 of the world's population. And I did just see, I think, was it the UK and the US are putting tariffs on China's, steel. Saw that earlier today.
Yes.
And so we'll have to see and wait to see what comes of the G20 meeting, Dave.
Yeah, everyone these days looks for the end of the summit communique or statement. It's a joint statement made by, well, theoretically all of the participants. That'll be a little more challenging this year since Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin won't be in attendance, although they reportedly are sending representatives. This will actually be the first G20 summit a Chinese president has missed since its inception in 2008. She attended virtually during the pandemic, as did other leaders. Biden said he's disappointed in Xi's decision because he had been hoping to meet with him there, but added he would get to see him without elaborating just what that meant. I mean, she did attend the BRICS summit in South Africa last month. There's speculation that Xi isn't attending because of China's tension with India, stemming back to an incident a couple of years ago on the Himalayan border that resulted in 24 deaths. And of course, Putin hasn't left Russia, at least knowingly, that we've known, since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him for alleged war crimes in Ukraine. Still expecting Ukraine and the war to be at the forefront of discussions. Looked on the website, didn't see anything about you know, the economy per se, particularly the global fight against high inflation and related issues. The theme of the summit this year is One Earth, One Family, One Future, supposedly drawn from the ancient Sanskrit text of the Maha Upanishad. According to the G20 website, the theme affirms the value of all life and their interconnectedness on the planet Earth and in the wider universe. So there you have it.
Isn't that special?
We'll come back better educated.
Kumbaya, yeah. Well, you know what's funny? Yes, we are one Earth, but one family, we are different. And one future, that's the problem. We all have, but anyway. But you know what I think, too? You know, that you made a comment about China's upset with India, maybe because of what happened a year or two ago. I think it's more about what happened in this past BRICS meeting, because there's some things China doesn't want to do. They don't want to play ball all the way with China because India doesn't want to cut or irritate the U.S. So they're still trying to jiggle the ball back and forth between the U.S. and China for India's people. So I have a feeling that might have a little bit more to do, or both, you know, but
yeah.
of the more recent, that was just last month. So, but drum roll. Jobless claims Thursday. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell, yay, to the lowest level in 7 months, with the labor market seemingly resistant to these higher interest rates to try to cool hiring. That's baloney. And you know what I'm thinking? Why are these claims falling? And I think I have an idea. Because people change jobs so quickly, probably since the pandemic to a point, and the ability, and I think the ease of getting unemployment has, at one point in time, anybody could get unemployment, you know, during and after the pandemic. And I don't think that's the case anymore. So if you don't work long enough in a place, in a lot of states it's 2 quarters or more, you don't qualify for unemployment. So I'm wondering, wouldn't that have an impact on why these jobless claims could be falling? People just don't qualify anymore because they have changed so many jobs and so forth.
Well, sure, that's possible.
And because they dropped.
It's certainly a factor, you would think.
And I think now it's harder to get unemployment, you know, like I think at one point in time they made it easier so people could file and get it, and I don't think that's the case anymore since the so-called pandemic is over.
Yeah, but if you remember, a lot more people qualified and benefits were enhanced during the pandemic, but we even talked about a couple of times on the program about how difficult it was, how many states had to go back to the drawing board so that people in their state could sign up, that there were, you know, all these technical snafus.
Well, that was for businesses, wasn't it?
That it was taking. Oh no, it was both. But I'm talking about unemployment in particular. Mm-hmm. That the state websites just took a long time to get up and running. People were waiting. People who did apply were waiting for months on end to get benefits. But I think you raise an interesting point that we should look out for. It's not just the numbers, as we like to say. It's the whys and wherefores. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be a big eye opener to learn that, to test your theory.
Yeah. So. Excuse me, the initial applications for the claims fell by 13,000 to 216. That was ending September 2nd. Jobless claims applications are seen as, of course, a representative of the number of layoffs in a given week. And the Fed is battling inflation. And what's next? What else do you want to say to that report?
There's not a whole lot of new information. I mean, I think the new information you mentioned, I mean, a lot of this other stuff is fluff that we've been talking about virtually every week, you know, about recent government data showing job openings dropped 8.8 million in July, the fewest since March of 2021. Things like that. I mean, again, layoffs in the tech sector earlier this year, other sectors trying to hold on to their workers. The only other number, I think, just overall, a little less than 1.7 million were collecting some kind of unemployment benefit, about 40,000 fewer than the previous week. And the four-week moving average of claims fell by 8,500 to a little over 229,000.
Well, here's another sector of the housing industry that's getting hammered with these rates so high, and that's the home equity loans. And there's people are far less inclined to tap into it with those higher rates. So people are not, you know, folks, homeowners are putting off kitchen renovations, other types of home improvements. And, you know, on the macro level, it's holding back hundreds of billions in consumer spending. In the second quarter, mortgage holders withdrew $39 billion in equity from their homes via home equity loans, lines of credits, cash out refinances. And that's about half of what homeowners withdrew in 2022, a year that started off with rates close to rock bottom levels. The withdrawal numbers have returned to where they were pre-pandemic, but keep in mind that homeowners have a lot more home equity now. Back in February 2020, the amount of tappable equity held by mortgage owners was around $6 trillion. By June of this year, that had grown to $10.5 trillion. And this is all by Black Knight. Whatever. Black Knight. Tappable equity is what a mortgage holder can borrow while still hanging on to a 20% equity cushion, Dave.
Yeah, that's the minimum banks require these days for home equity loans and the like. Black Knight estimates also that $200 billion in equity was left untouched over the past 15 months as interest rates began to rise. The cool down in home equity borrowing is one way the Fed's rate hikes are, well, doing what I guess the Fed intended them to do, chilling the economy to tamp down inflation. Not sure they expected the housing market to go into this nosedive it's been in. There was a point last year when you could get a lower rate on a home equity loan than a refinance. But that advantage has since gone away. Not only are mortgage holders now locked into the golden handcuffs of that, whatever, 2.5%, 3.5% rate that keeps them from selling their home, they're also increasingly locked out of borrowing to tap into all their shiny new equity that you talked about, Melody. Mm-hmm. Either way, it's more bad news for an industry that's been in recession for some time.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, folks, rising prices aren't going to go away. It's going to be more and more expensive. And, you know, I'm sure people right now are thinking, well, should I grab on to the 7% now? Is it going to go higher? And I don't know what it costs to buy back those points. You know, usually it's a pretty hefty fee to buy back those points to get a lower mortgage rate. So, but healthcare, next year they're predicting it to increase 6.5%. Employer health insurance costs are expected to increase significantly, and this is all according to the Wall Street Journal. The costs for health insurance coverage for employers are expected to increase around 6.5%. Now, this is the biggest increase in more than a decade. Driving the increase, well, you know, you have inflated labor costs for hospitals, large demand for expensive new diabetes and obesity drugs. All that is being passed down to insurance companies and new contracts with a hospital. And in these obesity drugs, you know, the ones that they use that are supposed to be for diabetics, there's little health offices popping up, and they just flat out lie. Y'all, this person's pre-diabetic. He needs to go. And it's like, it's amazing. And then you wonder what all the kickbacks are from the big pharma to do all this.
Well, so, Ozempic, one of those very popular new drugs, $400 for a 1 month supply at a local CVS.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And that's why they're doing it, though. We'll be right back. I hear the music. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with Dave Allen. Give us a call at Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And, of course, visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And we got some great prices. It's the beginning of the month. The month is going to be almost over before you know it. And so don't wait. Don't hesitate. Give us a call. And heading into the program, we were talking about the cost of your health insurance. And 6.5% heading upward. That doesn't sound like they have inflation under control, Dave.
Well, I'll talk more about that in the third segment, too. But, 6.5 for employers if you have your health care through the Affordable Care Act, through the government marketplace, you'll see your premiums rise by about 6%, about the same as this year. Might not seem a lot, but add up. 6 plus 6, you know, you're over 12% compounded. Plus, workers are likely to pay more out of pocket as employer shifts some of their cost onto employees. Now, despite the shift, the tight labor market may still push employers to shoulder a bigger share as hiring and retaining workers remain competitive. despite the Biden administration releasing that list of 10 drugs we talked about a couple weeks ago that Medicare will start to negotiate prices with drug manufacturers over to reduce costs. They're set to begin later this year, those negotiations, but remember, they won't go into effect until 2026, with companies being threatened with up to a 95% tax if they don't cooperate. I'm not sure where all of that is going to go, but I can tell you costs of your prescription drugs aren't going down anywhere soon.
Wow. I know, and that's, you know, and add in all the other additional costs when it comes to your health care. It's only going to go higher and higher. Let's go ahead and skip to the levity is golden, Dave.
Hey.
I think it's an important topic.
Yeah, as Axios's editor-in-chief Sarah Kihalani Gu, whose family is from Maui, writes, from a tragedy, sometimes an awakening is born. Well, that's what's hopefully happening in Maui, where those raging wildfires took out the entire town of Lahaina within hours of being sparked. The official death toll there stands at 115, but hundreds are still unaccounted for and presumed gone. More than 2,000 buildings in that city burned. More than 6,000 people have been displaced. And the community is asking, where do we go from here? Now that everything has to be rebuilt, residents are examining the bigger picture. It's come down to a balance between the locals and tourists, the infrastructure that was supposed to support them all, and how to honor the history of what was once the capital of the former Hawaiian kingdom. On an island where the average home now costs over $1 million, the fire adds urgency to easing a housing crisis that was already squeezing out many longtime residents, particularly their children. Keani Rollins Fernandez, who's a Maui County Council member, said this: "This is an opportunity for a government to step in and make right by the people who have been wronged for so long. It shouldn't be a land grab." Native Hawaiians point out that Lahaina and other parts of Maui haven't always been as dry as it is now, or full of invasive grasses that have been inclined to accelerate wildfires. Lahaina, in fact, was once a lush area with an enormous pond that's now filled in with a baseball park. Up the mountain, sugar barons diverted the water to irrigate their sugar cane plantations, letting Lahaina, which is downhill, dry up. Besides rethinking the island's electrical infrastructure, locals are asking officials to re-examine water resources. Maui officials and residents start to welcome back visitors. They encourage tourists to be respectful, not to visit the Lahaina area, and to consider volunteering. Literally take years for Maui residents, officials, and business owners to sort through these big issues. But as anyone who's lost a loved one knows, in loss, you appreciate what you had even more. What really matters tends to come into focus. And as Sarah Gu suggests, perhaps the only way for Maui to rebuild is to be intentional about doing better for the community going forward. And that, Melody, is this week's Levity is Golden.
It is such a tragedy, and you know, it'll take years and years and years, and you know, but it, you know, so we'll have to see how they fare. So, who is this new Fed leadership? The Senate confirmed Philip Jefferson as vice chair of the Federal Reserve and confirmed Lisa Cook for a full 14-year term as a governor. The Senate is voting on Adriana Kugler's nomination to be a governor, which appears on track for a narrow confirmation. Jefferson, who is an economist and a one-time Fed staffer who had been a governor since last year, will now officially be part of the top leadership. Traditionally, the Fed chair, vice chair, and president of the New York Fed form a triad that guides monetary policy. Jefferson's bipartisan 88 10 confirmation vote was a throwback to an earlier era when Fed nominees routinely attracted near unanimous Senate support. So they're going to get new guys in there. And
yeah.
they're not going to be able to do anything different than the ones that left, but oh well. That's my view.
Yeah, I guess we'll see, but I don't think there's a whole lot of reason to be optimistic.
No.
Now, though he may be less hawkish on a proposal that would force the U.S.'s 8 global systemically important banks to hold roughly 19% more capital, Jefferson says, my views on any proposed final Basel III endgame requirements for U.S. banking organizations will be informed by the potential impact on banking sector resiliency, financial stability, and the broader economy stemming from the implementation. More Fed speak, Melody. Now, while not a full-throated rebuttal like the one issued recently by Fed Governor Michelle Bowman, who argued there was insufficient evidence that the capital requirement proposal would justify the cost, Jefferson's stance leaves some wiggle room for support or revision or negotiation. He said in June at his confirmation hearing, he'd always be thinking about the trade-off between making banks more resilient and sound and credit availability. Now, there was some made it on by a couple of votes. Only one Republican voted for her nomination. There were concerns about her lack of qualifications.
Okay. Well, you know, markets were a little quiet today. And yeah. There's a big report coming out tomorrow. It's the August CPI numbers. And but I mean, yesterday, you know, the Fed came out with its beige book. And of course, that's a, just anecdotal commentary about the economy from all across the Fed districts. On Richmond, you've got the rich men in Richmond. Several service providers noted that wage pressure eased as the ability of labor improved somewhat, which helped to slow the increases of labor costs. Cleveland, compared to the number of contracts early in the year, a narrower set of contracts were willing or able to push through price increases. Most contracts in Philadelphia noted ongoing improvements in the supply chain with a return to normal for many, despite the uptick sentiment weekend. Boston manufacturing contracts, with one exception, reported stable or decreasing prices. Transportation, well, it's certainly a all glowing report, isn't it, Dave? Don't you think?
Kansas doesn't get much better elsewhere.
Oh, I know. Boy, oh boy. Kansas City, both manufacturing and service contracts reported compression in their profit margins in recent months as businesses were unable to pass all their higher costs onto customers.
Well, I'll tell you, there was a category, though, where inflation isn't easing, according to the Beige Book, and that's insurance. As we talked about another area just a short bit ago, health insurance, medical expenses. But here are some comments about insurance. From New York, both service firms and manufacturers reported that input price increases picked up a bit in recent weeks. One contact noted substantial increases in insurance costs. In Atlanta, property and liability insurance costs in coastal areas remained a top concern regarding housing affordability. In Kansas City, housing providers face more difficulty building new and maintaining existing affordable rental properties because substantial increases in insurance costs and financing, i.e. interest rates. And in Colorado, listen to this, property insurance premiums reportedly rose as much as 30 to 50% over last year, due in part to increased weather-related claims. And finally, San Francisco, where strong price pressures persist for other product and service categories like utilities, insurance-used vehicles, packaging, and some construction materials. So, the good old beige book, Melody, just full of
lies, full of misinformation. Anyway, we were talking about medical services and the increase in health insurance, and it's going to continue to rise. I mean, certainly with the baby boomers certainly needing it, and just the way things are processed anymore. I mean, our medical industry is really kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, but it certainly isn't what it used to be. And there's how health insurance prices are measured and how medical providers set prices have meant the sector has pulled some inflation down in months, but it's not going to stay there. It's going to reverse. It would exert a slight upward tug on overall inflation, a much larger one on core services, including housing, which is a measure of the underlying price pressures that we continue to hear the Fed officials emphasizing. And medical services account for 6.4% of overall inflation, but 27% of core services ex housing. Some of the CPI's components are measured simply to figure out the price of bananas, for example. Data collectors go to the grocery store and check. Others are a little more murky and theoretical. Health insurance is very much the latter. Its price and CPI calculation is not simply what you or your employer pays for health insurance, but rather it's based on insurers' retained earnings. Your health insurance, your health insurer's service isn't the health care itself. Doctor and hospital visit prices go on a different line of CPI.
They provide insurance services handling payments you would otherwise have to make yourself. So the price of health insurance is calculated by subtracting what they spend on health services for customers from the premiums they charge. Health insurers end up paying out more than expected to provide care, and their profits fall, well, that shows up in CPI data as a drop in the price of health insurance. I have to think this through a little more clearly to see how much, if any, sense that makes. But, I mean, on the one hand, it's confusing. On the other, wow, you look at some of the profits that the big insurers are making. Some of them are astounding, and a lot of them are technically nonprofits, or at least had been. But they're holding retained earnings of well in excess of $1 billion, sometimes several billion. And that's why the price of health insurance and the CPI. Well, no, that wouldn't make sense. I'm sorry, I looked at a part in this article that just didn't make sense. So I'm just going to move on to say the Bureau of Labor Statistics is saying that it will update its methodology for calculating health insurance starting next month. The basic method will remain in place, but BLS will smooth the retained earnings data and update the prices twice a year rather than once. Oh, well. Big bank economists like a too-big-to-fail Goldman Sachs expect the change will mean health insurance goes from falling 4% a month, as it has recently, to rising 1% a month starting in October. And that, I suspect, Melody, is going to give the Fed fits.
Yeah, but my question is, if they're using the basic method, it's going to remain in place, and just changing, why would it? So to me, it already has been rising 1% or more because they're using the same. The only thing difference, it's checking it twice a year rather than once, makes that much difference?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it all comes down to are retained earnings going up or down?
Do you smooth the returned? The retained earnings.
Well, it just means if in January
you round up or down.
You show you show you average. If it's $1 billion in January, but 500 million, say, in July, then the average would be, what, 750 million instead of a billion. Conversely, you know, if it's the opposite, well, you know, it's still going to be the same. It sounds like me, it's going to be another way to sort of suppress.
Yes, absolutely. I hear the music, so we're going to have to be suppressed.
We're going to have to suppress us.
Yes, we'll be right back. Don't say me.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of clients this final segment. You know where to get her, 1-800-375-4188. In a recent interview, Acting U.S. Labor Secretary Julie Hsu says the White House prefers to stay out of labor negotiations. Well, you could have fooled me. With the possibility of another economy-shaking strike on the horizon affecting auto workers this time, the Biden administration's stance on unions is an important factor in talks, whether they're at the table or not. As Sue explains, the idea is to refrain from meddling in a process that the pro-labor president believes in. Our stance, she explained, is to stay out. Respect the parties unless asked or unless there's some reason why we believe we could be helpful. President, I really believe in the collective bargaining process, she continued, which is premised on the parties coming together, sitting down, negotiating, grappling with hard things, and coming to a resolution. Well, that's what ultimately played out in talks between the Teamsters Union and UPS earlier this summer. White House stayed out of those negotiations, even as industry groups asked them to get involved. Now, a president getting involved in a labor dispute can mean a lot of different things depending on the politics of a given administration and the stakes in the labor battle itself. For example, a White House could sit at the negotiating table or even force a contract through over worker objections using federal law. That usually happens when the White House is by law required to get involved, like with the rail workers last year. Or they could sit at the table when asked. That's what happened earlier this year when Sue helped negotiate a contract at the West Coast ports. Or they could order workers back to the job. If a strike or a lockout happens in an economically crucial industry, a president can declare an emergency and put an end to it. Kaput. That's what happened in 2002 when President George W. Bush invoked the emergency provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act to reopen the West Coast ports during a very tense period of negotiations. Now, staying out of talks doesn't mean staying away completely, though. I mean, after all, these are politicians. The administration stays in touch with the parties when it comes to these big labor disputes. Biden has even assigned a point person at the White House, Gene Sperling, to keep in touch with the parties in the auto worker talks. Sperling isn't at the negotiating table, though. He's acting as the administration point person on questions that come up, like around any federal investments stemming from last year's so-called Inflation Reduction Act. The bottom line right now is the current UAW contract expires next Thursday. And industry insiders say a strike is a real possibility. Stay tuned. I sense at this point, based on the posturing that's going on both sides, even though there's been an offer by the automakers, I think there will be a short strike, hopefully short, that won't be too impactful on the out-of-job workers. Let's talk about space for a minute. SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, is empowering other companies and nations to reach their goals in space, but that could pose major challenges to those same companies. And we know Musk's space company is currently dominating the industry. Space Capital's Chad Anderson says there's no doubt that SpaceX is the most important company in the space industry right now. Who's even second, he asks. It doesn't matter who's second. SpaceX is so far ahead. The company has already launched 62 missions this year, far surpassing any other company or nation and already breaking its own record for most launches in a year. SpaceX also operates the largest fleet of satellites in orbit today, thousands of internet beaming Starlink spacecraft that provide internet connectivity around the globe. SpaceX's competitors are being forced into the uncomfortable position of relying on them. Companies like OneWeb that are attempting to build mega constellations of internet beaming satellites that could compete with Starlink are buying rides to space aboard SpaceX rockets. A lawsuit filed by an Amazon shareholder alleges Jeff Bezos' company didn't award a SpaceX a major contract for launching Amazon's mega constellation, and that potentially increased the cost of building the satellite network because of a personal beef between Bezos and Musk. Grow up, fellas. SpaceX is even eating into the small satellite launch market, driving down costs and undercutting other companies like Rocket Lab that are offering dedicated missions for small satellites. The government's also increasingly reliant on the company. SpaceX is the only U.S. entity currently able to send astronauts into orbit. And NASA's also relying on SpaceX's Starship, which is yet to successfully make it to orbit to land people on the moon as an essential part of its Artemis program. Musk himself also holds diplomatic sway. SpaceX's satellite have been crucial for war fighting in Ukraine thus far, raising further questions about the power the company holds, similar to Halliburton's pull in recent forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. SpaceX's innovation pushes the space industry in new directions, acting as a pacing entity that pushes not just other companies to new heights, but other nations as well. Those aren't my words. Those are the words of Secure World Foundation's Ian Christensen. SpaceX's success has proved to investors, he said, that the space industry could be a good return on investment, stoking interest in other companies doing different things. Well, part of SpaceX's supremacy in the industry today is a matter of circumstance. Europe's Ariane 6 rocket and United Launch Services' Vulcan Centaur, two likely SpaceX competitors, are experiencing delays ahead of their debut flights. The U.S. and other Western nations have pulled away from launching spacecraft aboard Russian rockets due to the war in Ukraine, and that's sending business, yes, to SpaceX and others. As those new rockets dominate or come online and others develop further, SpaceX's dominance in launch could start to decline. Other companies are also building mega constellations that could eat into Starlink's advantage. But I say competition is usually a good thing. Now, here's an interesting development in our post-pandemic world. Women are closing in on men as numbers in the workplace. For a decade, a far higher share of men work than women. Now that a gender gap is the narrowest it's ever been, according to the latest data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the latest numbers show that the labor force participation gap between men and women narrowed to just 10.5 percentage points in August. It's an all-time low. 68.2% of men are at work. 57.7% of women are. And just to show how much we've changed as a nation in that respect, the gap was over 50 points in 1950 in the early baby boomer days, when about 85% of men were at work and about 30% of women were. The BLS defines labor force participation of the percentage of a population that is either working or actively looking for work. Women are crushing it in the labor market right now. The return to work from the pandemic has been much faster than men's. The gender pay gap, again, also the narrowest on record. A big part of this is the rise of remote and flexible work, which has enabled a lot of women, particularly with younger children, to enter or remain in the workforce. But pandemic funding for childcare runs out this month, and many predict that could put some daycares literally out of business, force them to raise fees, which in turn could push a lot of parents, particularly mothers, out of the workforce and back home to look after the kids. We will see. Interesting story. Now, the global economy is in what some observers are calling a mild trade recession now, as shipments from China slump and German factories in particular downshift. China's export declines extended into August, though there were signs that the worst of a world trade slowdown may be over for the leading exporter, China. Overseas shipments from China fell 9% in dollar terms from a year earlier, while imports contracted 7%, both better than economists' estimates and significantly less than July's downturns. In fact, most other data have suggested that trade may be stabilizing after weakening for most of the year. Exports from South Korea also declined at a more moderate pace. Oxford Economics reports that global goods trade volume fell by about 2% in the second quarter, and that its leading indicators suggest more weakness ahead, but then an upturn at the end of the year and in early 2024. Now, according to Oxford, a shallow trade recession is in store, which sees volumes dropping 1.5% this year before rebounding 2.3% next. That's less optimistic than a recent forecast from the WTO, the World Trade Organization. In Germany, industrial output fell again, further holding back the world's third biggest exporter and casting a pall over the start of the third quarter in October. ING said that factory weakness is providing more evidence of elevated recession risk for the German economy. But the latest Kiel trade indicator offered some hope for a recovery. Vincent Stamer, who heads Kiel's trade gauge, says It remains to be seen whether German exports will really turn around as the weak global economy means demand for new German machinery and other capital goods tends to decline. Another interesting shift, according to Kiel, container ship traffic through St. Petersburg and other Russian seaports is surging. Despite a weak ruble and sanctions over its invasion of Ukraine, and is now close to pre-war levels. Stamer said where the goods are coming from isn't clear, but Russia seems to be rejoining world trade. That's pretty astounding. Hey, in his blog, Gold Bull Kelsey Williams writes that the renewed threat to trade tariffs by some presidential candidates here is a clear and present danger to the free trade and the world economy. He notes that trade is the lifeblood of economies, connecting nations and fostering prosperity. Tariffs are essentially taxes imposed on imported goods, supposedly to protect the domestic industries or to gain a competitive edge. Sometimes they're recommended and promoted by those who think they've identified an unfair advantage existing between trade partners. Now, even though most politicians say otherwise, tariffs, Williams continues, are guaranteed to produce net negative results that are much worse than any short-term theoretical benefits. One of the primary dangers of trade tariffs that he points out is the economic disruptions they can cause. When tariffs are imposed, they disrupt the equilibrium. Domestic industries might benefit in the short term, but at what cost? Since the prices of imported goods rise due to tariffs, consumers end up paying more for the things they want to buy anyway. Thus, tariffs often trigger a chain reaction, leading to retaliatory measures from targeted countries. Full-blown trade wars can result in sometimes leading to additional conflict. Just look at U.S.-China relations since that trade war erupted a few years ago. And you know what? Small businesses bear the brunt. Without the resources to absorb the increased cost imposed by tariffs, Williams points out they struggle. Small businesses struggle to compete with larger companies that have much more significant financial reserves. He also posits that trade tariffs can also distort the allocation of resources within an economy. When protectionist measures artificially support certain industries through tariffs, it can lead to what he calls inefficiencies. Resources can flow to industries that are protected rather than those that are genuinely competitive. This misallocation of resources, he says, hinders economic growth and productivity. In short, tariffs just don't work. Well, let me know how you feel about these thoughts. You can email me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's Dave Allen, A-L-L-E-N, .usa@yahoo.com. I'll read your comments on a future program. Hey, that's all the time we have for today. I'll be back next Tuesday. Reverend Butch here tomorrow to close out the week. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks, as always, to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I work all night. I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Got me.